This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. Our first guest is the New York Times executive editor, Dean Baquet. President-elect Donald Trump has had quite a contentious relationship with the press, or the dishonest press, as he sometimes calls it. He's tweeted negative comments about the New York Times, CNN, and journalists covering him for other media organizations. The Times has investigated Trump's real estate practices, his businesses and the potential conflicts of interest they pose, his taxes, and allegations from women who say he touched them inappropriately. Trump threatened to sue the paper after those allegations were published. Terry spoke with Baquet when, as you'll hear, she had a cold.
Dean Baquet, welcome to Fresh Air. Let me start by reading some tweets about the press and about the New York Times specifically, tweeted by Donald Trump. Here we go. If the press would cover me accurately and honorably, I would have far less reason to tweet. Sadly, I don't know if that will ever happen! Exclamation point. Wow, the New York Times is losing thousands of subscribers because of their very poor and highly inaccurate coverage of the Trump phenomenon. The failing New York Times just announced that complaints about them are at a 15-year high. I can fully understand that, but why announce? I canceled today's meeting with the failing New York Times when the terms and conditions of the meeting were changed at the last minute. Not nice. Perhaps a new meeting will be set up with the New York Times. In the meantime, they continued to cover me inaccurately and with a nasty tone! Exclamation point. The failing New York Times is so totally wrong on transition. It is going smoothly, and I have spoken to many foreign leaders. The New York Times states today that DJT, Donald J. Trump, believes, quote, more countries should acquire nuclear weapons, unquote. How dishonest are they? I never said this! Exclamation point. The New York Times sent a letter to their subscribers apologizing for their bad, in capital letters, bad coverage of me. I wonder if it will change. Doubt it. So, Dean Baquet, have you
forgive me.
Have you ever had a president or president-elect tweet criticisms of you like this, of your paper?
Well, I've never had anybody in my life tweet that much at me, but no, I've never. This is highly unusual. Part of it's funny. It's filled with obvious inaccuracies. I mean, for one thing, our subscriptions have gone up dramatically since the election and since the president-elect started tweeting. I've made no apologies for our coverage. I think our coverage was very tough but fair. No, but this is pretty unusual and creates all kinds of issues that are compelling for us.
So what is most confounding for you as the executive editor of the New York Times about how to cover Donald Trump's tweets?
You know, I don't find covering his tweets confounding, even though many of them are inaccurate, as we said. I mean, I think that's like basic blocking and tackling journalism. The president says something, you fact check it, you report it, and you say whether or not it's accurate. I don't find that confounding. I mean, I find a lot about covering Donald Trump confounding, as we did during the election, but I don't find that covering the tweets so confounding. I mean, I think it's journalism is holding powerful people to account. There's nobody more powerful than the president of the United States. What he says is important to question. If he tweets that he doesn't like something that he saw on television the night before, that's a different issue. But if he makes a tweet that involves national security, or if he makes a tweet that involves an appointment, or if he makes a tweet that involves an American company, you report it out.
So when Donald Trump says something that is not true, how do you decide if you want to call it a lie or just say it's not true or use a word like baseless? For example, he tweeted, mm-hmm. In addition to winning the Electoral College in a landslide, I won the popular vote if you deduct the millions of people who voted illegally. The New York Times headline was, Trump promotes a baseless claim on illegal voting, no proof of millions.
Right.
So what was the conversation like about what word to use there? Baseless, fraudulent, lie,
yeah.
Untrue?
That was a great headline. I think, this perplexes our readers because people want very simple resolutions to complicated issues of language, and I live in the world of language, and language is really important. I authorized and pushed us to use lie for the first time in relation to Donald Trump when he finally acknowledged that he thought Barack Obama was born in the United States. I thought there was no other word.
Can I read
that
headline? The headline was, Donald Trump clung to birther lie for years and still isn't apologetic. Is that the headline you're thinking of?
That's the headline I'm thinking about. And the story throughout uses the word lie. A lie implies that it was done with complete, total knowledge that it was a falsehood and that the person pushed it despite all evidence against. And I think what Donald Trump pushed about President Barack Obama not having been born in the United States was a lie. And I think there's no question he knew it was a lie. He said at various points that he had hired detectives to examine it, and the detectives had come back and said and found things that were really important and a big deal. I don't think there's any question that all of that was a lie in retrospect. That is different from the normal sort of obfuscation that politicians traffic in. That's different from the politician who says, my tax plan will save $1 billion, and when in his heart of hearts he knows it's $1.9 billion that it's not going to save, that in fact it'll cost people. That's different, and that's different partly because it's sort of the way people have accepted politicians talking. It's also, there is no clear answer to it. It's just, I thought this was just a different order of business. But we use baseless. We use incorrect. I think lie is an important word. I'm not reluctant to use it again, but it would have to be the right calculation.
Lie implies intent. So
lie implies intent.
Is that part of the calculation?
And to my mind, yes. To my mind, lie implies intent and long-standing intent. Not just intent as of yesterday, but intent over a long period of time. And I think Donald Trump pushed the birther lie for a long, long period of time. And to my mind, that makes no question that it was a lie.
So let me read a letter from a reader that the New York Times printed in response to the Times headline, Trump promotes a baseless claim on illegal voting, no proof of millions. So the reader, David E. Langford, wrote, I'm a former newspaper reporter, and he said he was saddened by the continuing blurring between editorial commentary and news coverage. In another age, the word baseless in your front page headline would have been reserved for the editorial page where it belongs. The Times and other respectable news organizations should resist the temptation to join others, most notably Fox News, as they drop their conclusion into news stories. Please allow me, the reader, to draw a conclusion for myself.
I think what I would say to Mr. Langford, and I've said this to a lot of readers with all due respect, is that that's a misreading of the history of news coverage in America. If you go back to the 1960s and look at the way the best news organizations covered the civil rights movement and covered discrimination against black people in the South, you will see very powerful language. I went back and I read the New York Times' coverage of Mississippi in the 1960s. It was really powerful. It was in the news pages. It was in the magazine. It was compelling, and it has stood up to the test of time. And I'm not making the comparison between Donald Trump and the civil rights movement. Just I want to make that clear. But this was an era when the most courageous journalists in the country, people like Jean Patterson, wrote front page editorials, used very powerful language. And I think had they obfuscated in the face of what they were witnessing, that would have been cowardly. And I think history would prove me right. I think that when we believe something is baseless, which is a real word, it's not an opinion. It is a word in the dictionary and it means without any foundation in truth. I think if that word can be used very clearly and in this case accurately, I think that's journalism. And I think, in fact, to do the opposite would not be journalism. It would somehow be using language as a guard instead of using language to do what it's supposed to do, which is to tell the truth. I'm very careful. Lie has not appeared a lot. Lie is a big deal word. It has powerful implications, and I will continue to be careful using it. On the other hand, if somebody says something that is known not to be factual, to actually say some people say it's factual and some people say it's not factual is a bad journalistic construct that was created, you know, I don't know how long ago, but is actually a relatively new one and has not existed for the life of journalism and probably should go away.
When did you become aware of the fake news that's all over the internet now and the impact that it's having?
You know, not early enough. Not early enough, to be honest. I bet most editors would say that. I think it was only near the end. I mean, I would get stuff myself and in my email and on my Facebook feed with outlandish allegations about the Clintons and outlandish allegations about other people. I guess I thought at the time that it was just sort of part of the traffic of the internet and we could ignore it and that people were ignoring it. I think I'm not convinced that it had impact on the presidential election, by the way. But I think that I wish I had paid more attention to it earlier than I did. I bet every news organization is saying that now. We wrote about it, but I wish we had paid more attention to it. I just thought some of it was so outlandish. Mm-hmm. The most outlandish one that's come into the news in recent days, that the Clintons ran a child porn ring out of a pizza shop in Washington, D.C. I guess I thought nobody would believe that. I thought that was so outlandish a claim.
Yes, until a man walked in with an assault weapon and started shooting.
That's right. And until we learned that the son of a future cabinet member sort of was retweeting it.
Yeah, and Donald Trump fired Michael Flynn, the son of General Michael Flynn.
That's right. who
Donald Trump has appointed as his national security advisor.
That's right.
So
that's right.
We're recording this interview on Wednesday, the 7th of December, and a headline in today's New York Times is "Fake News Spread, More Readers Shrug at the Truth."
Yeah.
So do you feel like fake news is affecting how people read the New York Times? Because one of the experts who's quoted in the article says that one of the effects of fake news is that it gets people to disbelieve real facts.
I think that if I understood then what I understand now, I would have taken it much more seriously. I think there's a group of people who are saying, enough. I want somebody who just tells me the truth, tells me the facts. But I do think that if there's so much fake news and so much stuff that people are believing, of course it hurts all of us. And I think Facebook and other platforms need to take it seriously, within the First Amendment, of course. And I think we need to devise more ways to go after it, write about it, and sort of take it down, meaning to make clear that it's not true. Of course, if you read the follow-up to Mike Flynn's son being removed from the transition operation, you'll also see that there were people who came back even after the shooting and said they still believed it.
So what are some of the things your reporters faced during the campaign covering candidate Donald Trump? At his rallies, he became famous for calling out the dishonest press, at which mm-hmm. a lot of people in the audience would boo and cheer.
Right.
Some reporters I know felt like directly threatened by that.
It was bizarre. I mean, on the one hand, many reporters for the New York Times and other publications felt threatened. He would point to reporters in the audience. He would accuse them of telling untruths in audiences where there was just where people were angry and loud, and it was really uncomfortable. On the other hand, can I say one odd thing about Donald Trump in the press?
Yeah.
I have never encountered a presidential candidate who is easier to get on the phone and to defend himself and to say what he has to say. Go back and look at all the coverage, all the tough stories about Donald Trump done by big news organizations like ours. He picks up the phone. He gives you comment, gives you denials. There's a story, a really compelling story that Jason Horowitz did about Donald Trump's brother who died. And Donald Trump had an older brother who died of alcoholism. And there's some very compelling quotes in there from Donald Trump. Jason Horowitz called him up and said at one point, "Do you think your brother's feeling that he was a failure had anything to do with your success?" And there's a pause on the phone, and he says, "I don't know." I say all that to say this is a complicated guy. It would be a mistake for people to say this is just a guy who wants to kill all reporters. This is a guy who also lives and has died on occasion by the press. This is a guy who pretty much owned Page Six in the New York Post. This is a guy who is a salesman. This is a guy who toots his own horn. This is a guy who likes to talk to reporters. This is a guy who writes handwritten notes to reporters. But it's also a guy who has said some of the most vile things about journalists of any politician of his generation.
Have you been on the phone directly with him?
I have met him. When I was a reporter on the Metro staff of the New York Times, I covered a hearing. And I was 30. And he called me after the hearing just to say how accurate my story was. He was buttering me up. And the first time he came to the New York Times and he met with the editorial board and I was there just as a bystander, he sent a handwritten note afterward just saying how great it was to meet me and how great my question was. I'm sure he wrote that note to 200 reporters, but all I'm saying, this guy's relationship with the press is really complex, really, really complex. It's not just screaming at the press. It's a really complex relationship.
You met with the president-elect. Part of it was on the record, part of it off the record. This was at the New York Times, a meeting between Times and
all Trump. Of the stuff involving the reporters and me was on the record, by the way.
Donald Trump had tweeted before the meeting, "I canceled today's meeting with the failing New York Times when the terms and conditions of the meeting were changed at the last minute. Not nice."
That was factually inaccurate. The ground rules were always the same. The ground rules were that we would have an on-the-record lunch with reporters and editors. There was no change to the ground rules, which is why, even after the tweet, he ended up showing up at the New York Times.
It
was a very polite discussion, by the way. It was not a tense lunch.
What was the biggest surprise at that meeting?
How open he was, how candid he was. You know, he answered every question. You know, he answered questions about foreign policy that Tom Friedman asked him. You know, who knows? History will tell us whether you know, he was playing to a group of people he thought he felt it necessary to play to. But, you know, he made some news. He said that he had no intention of launching an investigation into Hillary Clinton. He said he thought that it was time to sort of end the tensions with the Clintons. He said that was the biggest surprise, and the fact that he answered every question. And he opened up by saying that the press had been tough on him, that nobody had been tougher on him than the New York Times, but that that he hoped that over time that would change because he thought the New York Times was a great jewel in journalism. I agree that we're a great jewel in journalism.
Did Donald Trump try to make an implicit deal such as, if you're nice to me, I'll be nice to you?
No, he didn't say anything like that. In fact, we made the full transcript available to people so that they can see everything that was said. No, I think he would know that that's not a deal we would buy. What does being nice to us mean, right? I mean, if my choice is doing big investigative reporting or getting the sort of daily scoops that lubricate Washington, if my choice is doing real deep explanatory journalism or getting the sort of one-day-ahead leaks that fuel Washington, I like the leaks, but I'll take the deep-dive investigative reporting and explanatory reporting any day. And I think that's what our readers want from us. No, there was no implicit, explicit offer of a deal. I mean, I guess you could say that by saying nice things to us about how important a news organization we were, he was trying to make nice. But no, there was no implication of a deal at all.
When someone questions whether the New York Times is balanced or not during a campaign, for example, in its coverage of Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump, do you do like a counting where you count like the number of stories that have investigated Hillary Clinton versus the number of stories that have investigated Donald Trump? Is there like, you know, a metrics analysis of fairness, or do you measure fairness in another way?
No. In fact, I think balance is sort of I'm not sure I buy the construct of balance. To me, it's fairness. You should always ask yourself you would never say, I've done 17.3 stories that the Clinton campaign isn't going to like, and I've only done 14.7 stories that the Trump campaign isn't going to like, so let me do 3.6 more that the Trump campaign isn't going to like. I think not only will your head explode, but that's imbalance coverage, because to do that, you're actually having to turn up the volume on other stories to make them equal to the others. No, I think you say we want to be fair. fairness could mean that some candidate gets tougher coverage. Fairness could mean, that you look at Hillary Clinton's record on foreign policy, and we actually did a two-part series on Hillary Clinton's role in shaping Libya policy, which is her most important foreign policy endeavor. We didn't do a two-part series on Donald Trump's foreign policy. He didn't have one. We did much, much more reporting on Donald Trump's finances because the Clinton Foundation, we did much reporting on the Clinton Foundation, but we didn't do much reporting on the Clintons' finances because their personal finances were not in the league with Donald Trump and they weren't running as successful business people. I think once you get into the actual measurement of metrics, you make yourself crazy, and in fact, you'll actually end up being unfair because you'll have to do more of something and less of something else. And the role to me is, this is going to sound weird, but the role is you want each campaign to think you were really tough on them. And that's what happened in this case, that's for sure. I don't think any candidate of the Republicans or the Democrats, from Bernie Sanders to Hillary Clinton to Donald Trump, thought we were not tough on them. I think they all thought we were tough on them and said it.
Dean Baquet, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you. I really enjoyed it.
Dean Baquet is the executive editor of the New York Times. He spoke with Terry last Wednesday. Our next guest is Fox News host Megyn Kelly. She spent the past year and a half in the center of a storm. Two storms, actually. The first started in the summer of 2015 at the first Republican primary debate hosted by Fox News, in which she asked Donald Trump about his disparaging comments about women. That led to Trump tweeting derogatory comments about Kelly and to Kelly being bombarded by hostile tweets and death threats. Then last summer, after Fox News host Gretchen Carlson accused Fox News head Roger Ailes of sexually harassing her, Kelly came forward and said he'd harassed her 10 years earlier. Ailes was forced to resign. Now Kelly's written a memoir which concludes with chapters about these stories. It's called Settle for More. Her Fox News show, The Kelly File, is live weeknights at 9. Terry spoke with Megyn Kelly last Wednesday. Let's start by listening back to Kelly questioning Donald Trump in August 2015 at that Republican primary debate.
You've called women you don't like fat pigs, dogs, slobs, and disgusting animals. Your Twitter account
only
is
Rosie
several...
O'Donnell.
No, it wasn't. Your Twitter account.
Thank you.
For the record, it was well beyond Rosie O'Donnell.
Yes, I'm sure it was.
Your Twitter account has several disparaging comments about women's looks. You once told a contestant on Celebrity Apprentice it would be a pretty picture to see her on her knees. Does that sound to you like the temperament of a man we should elect as president? And how will you answer the charge from Hillary Clinton, who is likely to be the Democratic nominee, that you are part of the war on women?
I think the big problem this country has is being politically correct. I've been challenged by so many people, and I don't frankly have time for total political correctness. And to be honest with you, this country doesn't have time either. This country is in big trouble. We don't win anymore. We lose to China. We lose to Mexico, both in trade and at the border. We lose to everybody. And frankly, what I say, and oftentimes it's fun, it's kidding, we have a good time. What I say is what I say. And honestly, Megyn, if you don't like it, I'm sorry. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably maybe not be based on the way you have treated me, but I wouldn't do that.
Megyn Kelly, welcome to Fresh Air. You've had a year and a half.
Thank you for having me. Yes, I'm still sort of reeling from the amazing 18 months that we've all just gone through. I think a lot of people in the country are feeling that way right now.
So walk us through how you prepared that now famous question at the debate for Donald Trump. What did you want to get to with that question, and how did you decide how to phrase it?
Well, my co-moderators, Brett Baer and Chris Wallace, and I had divvied up the opening round with those 10 candidates into 3, 3, and 4 in terms of how many candidates each of us would have. And we understood that we were going to open up the debate with questions on electability, either in the primary or in the general. So, you know, are you too far left to convince these Republicans to make you their nominee, or are you too far right to win a general if you get through this primary season? Generally, you know, that's the goal, to figure out whether these guys are electable. And my research assistant prepared big binders for me on all of these guys. I had binders full of men. And I studied them all, you know, and you become a mini expert. You know, keep in mind, this is August, of course, of 2015, before this race had really gotten going. And so we didn't know a lot of the things that we now know about these guys. And in particular on Trump, no one had focused in on his very controversial history when it comes to women. And if you just had an open mind in reading this binder, it was very clear that this was going to be his Achilles heel. And I felt like I needed to craft the toughest question I could for him on that controversial history.
So you crafted a pretty tough question. One of the things I hear listening back to that clip is that when he says, oh, only Rosie O'Donnell, he gets cheers. People are cheering and applauding. And when he says, oh, the big problem is just, you know, people being PC, people in the audience seem to really be with him. How did you read that?
Well, of course, I was well aware of his feud with Rosie O'Donnell. And there was a reference to something he had said about her in my question. But I would never have actually asked him that question if it had only been Rosie O'Donnell. Not because his comments about her were fine, but because she gave it pretty good to Trump as well. Mm-hmm. And they had a vicious back and forth. I probably would have moved on pretty quickly in considering that as a question if it had just been Rosie. With all due respect to her, if you look at what she said about Trump, you'll understand what I mean. But anyway, it wasn't just Rosie. And so I sort of understood where the audience was going with that. I certainly was not going to laugh. It would have been highly inappropriate, nor did I find it funny. But I understood this is probably a group that remembered the back and forth that they had. And listen, you know, she's probably not a favorite in Republican circles, and this is a Republican debate with a Republican audience. So I just sort of held my fire, let it pass, and moved forward. But it was very clear to me as well that, as I said in the question, it went well beyond her.
Yeah. And then he said to you, I don't have time for political correctness. I've been very nice to you, although I could probably not be based on the way you treated me, but I wouldn't do it. And he gets lots of applause for that, too. So did that surprise you? Did you feel like the audience was siding with Donald Trump against the women who he had insulted?
Not in that moment. Not in that moment. I think, you know, my own read on it with a couple of days perspective after it happened was they were applauding him for being not PC and being strong, right? This is what voters related to in him all along, that he was strong and he was not afraid to take on a Fox News anchor, even on a presidential debate stage. And I do think there's a lot of people in our society who have had it with PC culture. And I, Terry, am one of those people. You know, I think we have gone too far into the PC culture, but there's a limit to how far we can take that. You know, you may find somebody refreshing until they drop the N-word on you, and then you're no longer feeling refreshed. You're just feeling offended. And where we draw that line as a society is sort of akin to what the Supreme Court said on pornography. You know it when you see it, and it's different for each person. But I would submit to you that Trump's history of comments on women go well beyond the line if you look at them in their entirety, past just the normal backlash to PC culture.
He famously said about you after your question, when he was being interviewed, I think, by Don Lemon, you could see that there was blood coming out of her eyes, blood coming out of her wherever. She's a lightweight, and I couldn't care less about her. So the famous blood coming out of her wherever, did you interpret that as menstrual blood?
You know, to be honest with you, I really didn't know. I understood immediately that it might be a reference to that. I mean, I'm not an idiot. I understood what he might be suggesting. But after the fact, he denied it. But I was stunned when I heard what he said. And if you listen back to that whole interview, it wasn't just those comments. He was so angry. You could just hear how angry he was, which was a little jarring. I'm used to politicians being angry with me, you know, because I don't work for them. I work for my viewers. So I'll beat up on Republicans and Democrats alike, and they don't like it, and I'm used to that. I just wasn't used to the level of vitriol that was already starting to emerge.
So you write in your book that 4 days before the debate, he had threatened you that he could unleash his, quote, beautiful Twitter account on you. What was the occasion for that threat?
So 1 week prior to the first GOP debate in 2015, I had a segment on the Kelly File that Trump did not like at all. What had happened was the Daily Beast, in response to Trump's presidential campaign announcement, you know, that Mexico's not sending its best people, they're sending rapists and so on. The Daily Beast had dredged up Trump's divorce proceedings from Ivana Trump 30 years ago, in which Ivana, in sworn deposition testimony, alleged that Donald Trump had raped her. I mean, just brutally raped her. And it was offered in great detail, and it was a very ugly story. And she gave this testimony under oath. However, she had later recanted it. And Tim Mak of the Daily Beast was reporting on this. So, and the story had gone everywhere. You know, it was not just the Daily Beast. It was in Politico, it was other publications. And I decided to put him on the Kelly File just to ask him why he thought this was relevant. You know, I gave him a hard time. You know, it's 30 years ago. It's a divorce proceeding. People lie all the time in their divorce proceedings, especially when custody is an issue. How did you account for that in your reporting? It was fine. I would say it was a fair and balanced segment. He got to say what he wanted to say, but I tested him on whether this was a fair report. Well, Trump didn't like it at all. He didn't want me giving it any airtime. And he was supposed to come on the Kelly File that Monday night before the Thursday debate, just as a regular segment, but he refused to come unless I called him personally. So I did, and he was very angry and just kept insisting that I shouldn't have put it on the air. I said, hey, I did you a favor. You know, everybody was talking about that story without even contextualizing it or discussing the fact that Ivana had recanted that testimony and so on. He didn't see it as a favor. And what he said was, you know, Bill O'Reilly didn't run that story. I said, well, Bill is not my editorial gauge. He said, you had no business putting that on your show. I said, Mr. Trump, you don't control the editorial on the Kelly File. And Terry, it was like a switch flipped. I really think that was the first moment that it started to occur to him that that was true, that despite months of attempting to woo me, not romantically, but just, you know, into favorable coverage, which hadn't been successful for him, and then, you know, this moment of trying to threaten me into favorable coverage was clearly not working for him. And he became very angry, and he told me that I was a disgrace, that I ought to be ashamed of myself. And that's when he said, I almost unleashed my beautiful Twitter account against you, and I still may.
You did get a lot of tweets. I mean, Trump tweeted about you. People tweeted at you. Tell us what's like to be on the receiving end of Trump's beautiful Twitter account. Huh.
Well, listen, it unleashed a chaos in my life unlike any I had ever experienced. And that's saying something because I have been attacked by media critics and just critics of my own for years. And that, unfortunately, is part of the job in 2016 America. I was used to that, and I've developed a thick skin. But this was something of a different order entirely. I was receiving death threats regularly. I mean, serious death threats against me, against my family. Strange men showed up at my apartment building demanding to see me in a threatening manner. People started casing my home. Photographers were found on our property. I don't know whether they were private investigators or what they were, but people started digging into my past, bothering my mother, bothering my closest friends, bothering my old high school friends, trying to dig up dirt on me.
Well, how do you feel now? Trump is the president-elect. He's going to become president in a few weeks. There is no evidence as of yet that he's going to be reducing his tweets, reducing his angry tweets about the press. You're going to continue to cover him, I'm sure. But I'm just curious what it says to you that he's president now and what your concerns are.
Well, for me personally, I'm not concerned because, you know, Trump and I are in a better place now. I went to Trump Tower. It had been 9 months of relentless behavior on his part. Just when you would think he had finally gotten it out of his system, he would start in again on me. And my boss had tried to shut him down. The executive vice president, Bill Shine, had tried to shut him down. Sean Hannity, who is obviously a friend of Trump's, had tried to shut him down. And no one had been able to. And finally, I just realized by the time we got around to April of 2016 that it was going to be up to me. And so I got a meeting with him at Trump Tower. I went in there. And honestly, as soon as he laid eyes on me, it was as if all was in the past. He was generous. He was the magnanimous Trump that, you know, you read about. And he could not have been nicer to me. And listen, I was not conciliatory toward him, nor was he toward me. But we had a good exchange. And then I did this softer focus interview with him for the special I did. And it was a great reset. But in any event, as far as the country goes, I don't know. I think that I hear people say he's going to destroy the country. The country's going to be changed forever. I don't know if I agree with that. I think that Trump is probably a lot more in the middle than he sounded on the campaign trail. I don't think he's an ideologue. So it's not really his policies that I think are going to maybe fire people up. It's his rhetoric and, you know, his willingness to wield power in a manner that can be potentially exploitative and dangerous.
I'm glad that you were able to hit reset with him and you now feel like you are in less danger. On the other hand, it doesn't undo the things he said about you. It doesn't undo the danger that you say he put you in. And it doesn't change the temperament that he revealed in his comments about you and in his tweets. That exists. That's history. That happened.
Mm-hmm. Well, honestly, that was one of the reasons why I wanted to document it in the book. I felt it was important that there be a historical record of what he did, which was unprecedented in modern American politics for a candidate to go after a journalist in the way he did me. And I was not the only one he went after. I was just a particular favorite, we'll put it that way. Some people have said, oh, well, why didn't you come out with all of this before the election? And I've said, look, you have to understand, first of all, nothing I write in this book would have changed the election. If you don't think the Access Hollywood bus or the 12 female accusers or the Khan family or Judge Curiel changes election, you think my book would have changed it. You know, you're deluding yourself. But the thing is, I was dealing with this not only as a journalist, but as a person, you know, as a woman, as a mother. And what I was trying to do was not chum up those shark waters, you know, with more blood to create more attacks. I was trying to get out of that shark tank so I could restore sanity and safety to my life. And I did that. And so I do worry about the press and a President Trump. You know, I think it's dangerous, the entire delegitimization that he's engaged in against all of the media, because the people, as much as it's fun to hate us, they do need us. You know, they need good, strong, skeptical journalists to be covering whoever it is, whether it's Barack Obama or President Donald Trump. And we're in a dangerous phase right now where too many millions of Americans aren't listening at all to what the press tells them. And that concerns me. And the relative lack of power of certain minority groups and the fear they're feeling in the wake of Donald Trump's election, I think is something we really need to take a look at, because while I don't think Trump wants to target any particular minority group, I understand their fear because he spent many months stoking it. And so I think that's a legitimate thing we're going to have to deal with and ask ourselves, you know, how far he can go in enacting certain policies that target specific groups.
Thank you so much for talking with us. And also thank you for doing this in spite of the fact that you have a cold. I really appreciate that very much.
I am grateful to be here. I really am, and I'm grateful to your listeners, too, for giving me all the time.
Megyn Kelly speaking with Terry Gross. Kelly's new memoir is called Settle for More. She hosts The Kelly File weekday evenings at 9 on Fox News. Our book critic Maureen Corrigan has her list of the 10 best books of the year. From historical fiction to rock and roll memories to biographies of nasty women, it's a packed list.
I hesitate to say it, but the one word that characterizes my best books of 2016 list is serious. These books aren't grim, and they're certainly not dull. But collectively, they're serious about tackling big, sometimes difficult subjects, and they're also distinguished by seriously good writing. The Underground Railroad by Colson Whitehead is my pick for the book of the year. When Whitehead made his debut in 1999 with The Intuitionist, he was praised for his ingenuity. After all, who thinks up a novel about race featuring elevator inspectors? The Underground Railroad, set in antebellum America, is every bit as imaginative, while its vision of the surreal insanity of racism is even more devastating. Whitehead's premise is that the Underground Railroad was an actual network of trains running beneath the soil of the American South. His story follows an enslaved woman named Cora in flight from a plantation in Georgia. Whitehead's novel bows to other great African-American writers, from Harriet Jacobs to Ralph Ellison, who've chronicled similar journeys. Yet, even in doing so, Whitehead's Underground Railroad is one of a kind. Two other terrific novels this year also confronted slavery. Homegoing by Yah Jesse was the best debut novel I read. It's a vivid, multi-generational family saga that opens in 18th century Ghana with a depiction of the slave trade among Africans. Underground Airlines by Ben H. Winters approaches the topic of slavery through the genres of alternative history and noir suspense. Winters' novel is set in a present time where the Civil War never happened and slavery still exists on corporate plantations in some southern states called the Hard Four. Jonathan Safran Foer's Here I Am is also set in the present. It's a thick novel about a marriage and family falling apart, a personal disaster paralleled on a grand scale by a devastating earthquake in the Middle East. The Wonder by Emma Donoghue is just that, a wonder of a story about religious delusion and self-denial set in 19th century Ireland. Like her 2010 breakout novel, Room, which was also a film, The Wonder is set in a confined space, but these small rooms of Donoghue's teem with drama and great moral questions. Olivia Lang also writes about small rooms in her arresting hybrid work of memoir, biography, and criticism called The Lonely City. Lang investigates the connection between loneliness and creativity in the work of artists like Edward Hopper and Andy Warhol. For most of her life, Eleanor Roosevelt battled bouts of depression, which she called her Griselda moods, that stemmed from her lonely childhood. In the third and final volume of Blanche Weazin Cook's grand biography of Eleanor Roosevelt, Cook chronicles how Eleanor nevertheless contained her personal demons to push for New Deal programs and civil rights, even as FDR's attention was claimed by the war. Another woman who wasn't afraid of a good fight is the subject of one of this year's most compelling biographies. Eyes on the Street by Robert Cannigal traces the life of Jane Jacobs, the writer and activist who fought Robert Moses' plan to build an expressway through the heart of Lower Manhattan. Jacobs also wrote The Death and Life of Great American Cities, one of the classic books about New York. Two memoirs complete my list of the year's best. Bruce Springsteen's Born to Run is a lyrical and self-aware spin on the essential American story of the kid from nowhere who grows up to become somebody, in this case, the boss. About holding on to his roots, Springsteen says, "I didn't want to erase, escape, forget, or reject. I wanted to understand. No one you have ever been and no place you have ever gone ever leaves you. the new parts of you simply jump in the car and go along for the rest of the ride. Most of us move forward in denial that the ride will someday end, but neurosurgeon Paul Kalanithi was caught up short at the age of 36 by a diagnosis of stage 4 lung cancer. His posthumously published memoir, When Breath Becomes Air, is by turns a raw and elegant inquiry into the meaning of it all in the face of death. Several times he quotes the famous Samuel Beckett line, "I can't go on, I'll go on." His memoir is in part Kalanithi's own way of going on. That's a qualified kind of miracle that books make possible.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. You can find all of Maureen's year-end recommendations at freshair.npr.org. And to browse more than 300 titles recommended by NPR staff and critics, visit the Book Concierge at npr.org/bestbooks. Fresh Air Weekend is produced by Teresa Madden. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our technical director and engineer is Audrey Bentham. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Roberta Shorrock, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Mooj Zaidi. Molly C.V. Nesper is our associate producer of online media. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.